Anvil overhead doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danvil overhead doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Someone once said, love is blind, friendship closes its eyes. It rings true, but of course there's so much more. On the program today, we're going to explore some of the terrain of friendship with writer and editor Joseph Epstein. Friendship is the subject of his most recent book, Friendship, an Exposé. The idea for the book was suggested by one of Joseph Epstein's friends, Arnie Glass. One day over coffee, Glass said, "It's a subject about which no one has told anything like the full story." Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments on friendship for our guest, Joseph Epstein. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Joseph Epstein is the author of many books, including Snobbery, the American Version. He was formerly the editor of The American Scholar. His work has appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker and Harper's. Friendship, an Exposé is published by Houghton Mifflin. Joseph Epstein lives near Chicago, and this evening, July 13th, 2006, he'll give a talk in Chicago in Newberry Library's Ruggles Hall. That event is set for 6 p.m. this evening. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Epstein, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a great pleasure, Ms. Quinn. Thank you for having me.
At times, you say you felt as though you were writing your autobiography as you were writing this book, and I think that's a very interesting thought.
I've read a number of books on friendship of a how-to kind, where they invent these characters who are, you know, these impossible characters who are friends, you know. Ken, an airline steward, and Felicity, CEO of a major Saudi oil company, you know, and they always feel so false and thin. And when I felt in writing this book, and I'll say some more about why I had to do this, was that I really had to talk about my own experience in a kind of central way, because there aren't really any impressive studies of friendship that allow one to just sort of bandy around, you know, various sociological studies and this kind. And besides which, I'm a writer who always seems to have done this. The worry, of course, when you do this is that you'll fall into sheer egotism or solipsism, and my experience will be totally unlike anyone's, and people will just say, well, you know, he's just crazy. I mean, I don't feel like that. But what I've felt about my own scribbling over the years is that I seem often, and I think a certain kind of writer does, I seem to feel and to be able to formulate what with some precision sometimes what other people feel only incoherently. And it's always rewarding to me when someone says, you know, what you said is something I've always thought but never thought to quite put it that way. Mm. So I hope it applies in this case.
Yeah.
All this personal stuff is not, you know, simply egotism and simply or lapsing into solipsism.
I don't think so. I didn't find that at all as I read it. And
no,
I think, you know, if that's the case, people will just chuck the book aside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think another reaction that I've had from a number of readers, and, you know, these are the early weeks of its appearance in print, is a lot of saying people saying yes or no, that's not how I feel. And it's a kind of book that I think intelligent people argue with, within themselves, which is good. I think that would please me if that were the case.
Yeah. Well, I know for myself one of the things, and I haven't had enough time to do this yet, but I would really like to think more about the idea of friendship within marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big topic.
Mm-hmm.
I am married. And
I am married.
Yeah.
And actually, this is my second marriage. As my wife would say, this is my last marriage. I'd always want something in some little notes that he lives in Evanston, Illinois with his second wife.
So
doesn't that imply a third?
Yeah.
Or a fourth? It doesn't, in fact. And I have... I like to think I got it right the second time, you know, that I really have married the right person. And my wife is, I think, my best friend. And a lot of marriages are like that. And I think they're, in many ways, the most successful ones. I don't think they were always like that, but I think there's more and more of that.
Why do you suppose that's the case?
Well, I think it's the case in this instance because I tend to be rather reticent about confiding in people. You know, I think one of the new divisions of humanity are those people who are more therapeutic minded, and those who aren't. Those who feel that telling their troubles makes them feel better, which I think it genuinely does for certain people, and those people who feel when they tell their troubles, nothing. All they're doing is complaining and telling their troubles.
Yeah.
And my wife is my only real confidant, I think, and I think I'm hers. And of course, there are things I can't tell her, you know, which I just cheerfully repress. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this is one of the sort of slightly new changes in friendship, is that people use friends as a surrogate psychotherapists in some ways, people to unload their difficulties on, their sadnesses, their troubles, their disappointments. And for some people it works very well, and for others it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, you make the observation that in marriage, in a marriage that you and I think you and the two of us would agree that we really, that we want to be truly who we are. We want to be safe. We want to be loved. And and that's the kind of marriage that I think is the best kind.
Yeah, I do too. That, you know, the only thing wrong with such a marriage, if I may say so, is that when one of the two people dies, the other is lost, you know, both a husband, wife, and a dearest friend, and it's the more devastating, but still in all, you can't cover all the bases, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe you would talk a little bit about your father here.
Yes, in the book, I talk about sort of the family background. My father was an extraordinary man. He never finished high school. He was a Canadian from Montreal. He came down and he worked at various jobs as a salesman, and eventually he went into business for himself. And he made a small but real success. And he was a man who seemed to need no friends. Again, his chief friend was his wife. And his family was his almost his entire social milieu, you know, extending out a little bit to a cousinage, which was cousins were stronger, I think, 50 years ago, the relations between cousins and extended family than perhaps they are today with everyone moving around. But it was a kind of standing joke in our house. If the phone rang, my father would say, "If it's for me, tell them I'm out of town." And, of course, it never was for him. I don't think in the history of my entire boyhood was it ever for him. But he didn't seem somehow to miss the idea of friendship, male friendships at all. Such social life as he had was led through my mother. You know, my mother would, they might go out with couples, but she was clearly the playmaker of the whole social life. It was never people he met and introduced my mother to, it was people my mother knew and then introduced him to. But he was so self-sufficient that one never felt in him a sense of loneliness. He was also, I should add, a man without leisure activities. He, you know, he didn't golf. He was a comically inept card player because the cards were a good deal of middle class recreation in those days, bridge and gin rummy games and poker. And he had no interest really in that. And he mostly read newspapers and magazines. He didn't really have the patience to read longish books. And he worked 5.5 days a week and thought a lot about his business. And was a very kind of good but not full court press father. But the whole idea of friendship just didn't enter into his social arrangements.
Hmm.
A bit unusual, I think.
Yeah. And then when your mother died, mm-hmm. he was bereft.
Oh, yes, he was utterly lost, and he sort of spent a year wandering in the jungle of not knowing where he was. And his wife was also a wife of a kind that made it easy for him not to know where clean shirts came from, you know, kind of full-court press wife.
Yeah.
And although my mother worked with him in his business toward the maybe the last 20 years of his active working life. But, at some point, and I don't know if you've sensed this, I think we all do at some point, sometimes with some surprise, one says, you know, I think my mother was more penetrating than my father, or my father than my mother, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they had very different talents, but my mother had very good social antenna, and she was a completely unsnobbish person, and she just sort of looked for people who had a good heart, which she herself did. But she could sort of size a person up in a way that my father wasn't so even interested in doing particularly.
Mm.
I should tell you another thing. They were a couple. Now, these are people who were born in, 1908, 1912, those years. And they were also what I would call pre-psychological. That is to say, therapy wasn't a serious option for them. They wouldn't understand the concept. When my mother was my mother in her early 80s had cancer, and it was clear it was going to be terminal. And somebody said to me, "You know, there are wonderful support groups for people who have dying of cancer." And they talk to each other, and it's a comfort to them and so forth. And let me go back a moment and say my mother was obviously, for good reason, depressed, at, you know, knowing she was going mm-hmm. to die a little earlier than she had planned on. And someone said, "Your mother ought to join such a group," when I mentioned to this person her depression. And it occurred to me, if I said to my mother, "You know, Mother, there are such groups. Would you like me to look into one for you?" She would have said, "Let me get this straight," she would have said. "You think that if I tell my troubles to strangers, I'll be happier? Is that what you think?" And I could see that one eyebrow going up, you know.
Yeah.
Is this the kind of son I've raised? I think that generation was less psychologically attuned, less therapeutic than the ones that came after, including ours. I must say, I'm not sure that the ones that are psychologically attuned are all that much better for it. I mean, that's, in some ways, in my mind, a controversy.
What are your thoughts about friendships between parents and adult children?
That's very interesting. I now have an adult son, and there's a proverb that I really like that seems to apply to him, and it says, "When your son becomes a man," and I should think the same thing would be true of when your daughter becomes a woman, if you're a mother. When your son becomes a man, make him your brother.
Mm.
And I do have that feeling about my son, and my son is certainly in that circle of my dearest friends as well. I have the feeling my son is a lot smarter than I am. That he can handle more chaos than I. He can do a vast amount. So that's a whole new question. It would be terrible to, as a child, you know, to still be thought of as a child when one is in one's 30s and 40s and
mm-hmm.
50s and such, you know. But that hasn't obtained in my own life.
Yeah. Well, there comes a point, and I don't know what happens, mm-hmm. but if things are going well between parents and adult children, there comes a moment when You can just have a really wonderful time.
Yes, I know. Isn't it extraordinary?
Yeah.
I know. It's in fact, I, with this same son I'm talking about, when he was quite young, I remember, I think he was 11, and we were sort of out. I had to have some tires changed on our car, and we had to wait 3 hours for them to do all this. And I said, you know, this is a very nice young man, this kid. I hadn't noticed. He's 11 now. It's true. I sound like my father. But he's a really winning kid. And he always has been somehow in that regard. There's a Freudian joke, and I think we should get to Freud in a moment. But I don't know if you've heard it, but the joke is, why do grandchildren and grandparents get on so well? And the answer is because they have a common enemy.
Yeah,
I do know the joke. You know, but yeah. I was rendered very lucky. In that my parents sort of left me alone without a great deal of psychological Sturm und Drang, so that I didn't grow up, you know, hating my mother. And it seems to me such a sadness and such a waste of time to have to live, you know, your life full of resentment against your parents, even if the resentment is real, you know, that they were monstrous in some ways. But I have friends who are still, you know, in their late 60s, are still can't square things up with daddy, and it just seems a sadness.
Mm. Well, this is interesting. Let me reintroduce you and the topic in the program, and then we'll talk about pre-psychological and Freud and other things here this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Joseph Epstein, his most recent book, Friendship and Exposé, and that's our topic this afternoon, friends and friendship. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, an observation about friendship. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, you're not a fan of Freud. Why not?
No, I'm a writer, and I think in part an artist. I write books of stories and things. And I think anyone who is an artist, and I think you'll find this is true of Vladimir Nabokov and others who've thought about Freud, don't like what we would call the determinism of Freud. You know, in the Freudian schema, life is pretty much set by your second or third year. You know, how well you were breastfed, how carefully you were hugged, you know, early relations, at the Oedipal complex, and all that stuff. And it, to a real artist, it feels like the sheerest baloney, if I may say so. Time has now made it not just seem like baloney, but has authenticated it as baloney. I think the psychiatrists now, the Freudian psychiatrists and psychoanalysts now say, well, you know, this Oedipus complex thing, it's over. We were wrong about that. In fact, there are people whose whole lives were enthralled to psychoanalysis, in which they were trying to work out Oedipal relations with their mother and father, which probably never existed. I'm so anti-Freudian in some ways that I feel that Freudian psychoanalysts, like Germans after World War II, ought to be made to pay reparations to their patients for, you know, for this kind of stuff. The other thing about Freud that puts me off a great deal, and especially in connection with friendship, is that Freud eroticized everything, as you know. It was all about sex. And the Freudian theory of friendship is really that there is no friendship. It's just a kind of guise for people wanting to jump into bed together. You know, he called male friendships and female ones, too, aim-inhibited homoeroticism. That just seems to me, on the face of it, you know, stupid and even pernicious to believe that. But people did believe it for a long time, with the sad consequences. You know, it would make it impossible, for example, I think, if you really believe that, for a man and a woman to have a non-sensual relationship. And I know they can have them because I have some, you know, with women that I value enormously, and I'm I'm not sitting there the entire time thinking, how can I, how can I possibly seduce this woman? You know, it's so I think. But Freudianism, in a funny way, there is no real theory of friendship, and Freud supplies the only one, and it's not very good. If I'm correct about all this, it's, I mean, he said all sorts of smart things. You understand, but I think his central ideas. That is the early determination of character by weaning and breastfeeding and stuff, and the emphasis on sexuality in these few Greek myths just seemed to me not to touch in any way the complex reality of human existence.
Did he have any friends?
Freud, it's interesting. Freud did not have any really close friends. He had the Freudian circle, which you must probably know about, and over the years, they all fell away, I think. But, you know, you're asking that question touches on another point, and that is very few great men and or women are known for having lots of close friends. I don't think I've just done a lot of reading about French history, and no one ever talks about Napoleon's good friend, you know, or I've been reading about Tolstoy, who had no close, good friend. You know, they were friends, but they weren't close. And I have the feeling that the larger a person's ambition, the less likely he is to have friends. In Rome, there are all kinds of friendships, but they're often about politics. You know, friends who will back you up and, save you from enemies. In fact, many political friendships are really about having common enemies. But to get back to Freud, I don't think he was thought of as a great figure in the history of friendship.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Does one need to have lots of friends?
That's in a way is close to the heart of my book. Plutarch, the Roman historian and biographer, says a man or woman shouldn't have more than 7 friends. Wouldn't it be nice to have that kind of authoritative? Well, you must cut out 3, you know. I see you have 10, Celeste. Which 3 do you want to cut out?
And we'll send them that Hallmark card you've designed.
Exactly. Yeah,
tell our listeners about that.
Well, the card, one of the reasons I think that friendship has not been written about very well in recent decades is that the Hallmark view is the one that it seems to prevail. And the Hallmark all-purpose card in friendship would read something like, my friend, and then you open it up and it would say, to a special person, caring, sharing, always there for me. You know, that's the standard sort of psychobabblous view. Mm-hmm. My card would say, we've been friends for so long now, why don't we stop? Which happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But when you ask that question, I have to about how many friends should one have or how many do I have. I have an unseemly number of friends. And for this book, I counted them up, and I think it's somewhere between 75 and 80. And the reason for it is, some of the reasons are the following. One is that I live in the city in which I grew up, Chicago. So I still have friends from even grammar school days and high school days. Another is that I taught at a university for a number of years. I taught at Northwestern. And I would find myself falling in love with students. And over the years, what to me seemed the best of these students, maybe 20 or 25 of them, I've stayed in touch with and have, you know, feelings of really deep affection for them. So you add those two. And then I've acquired a number of friends through, the normal professional way as a writer, dealing with editors who, you know, one starts out with a utilitarian relationship and it deepens and warms up. And also people who write to me about my writing. And again, the friendship, something like a friendship develops, not often in person, which is another thing we should probably talk about, that you don't even have to sort of see people to have them become friends in this, you know, the age of advanced technology.
Yeah, you could skip the Hallmark card idea, and you could text message that.
That's it.
Thanks for being my friend. Now stop.
Yeah, bug off.
Yeah.
Right. Or just simply notice that they've been cut.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that you argue for in the book, too, that the nature of friendship is undergoing some change.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had the telephone forever, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have email.
Yes. Well, you know, in the telephone, too, I think the telephone, there are a couple of things now going on with the telephone technology that's of interest to friendship. One is the notion of caller ID. I happen to be a pretty serious telephone schmoozer. You know, with the right person, I can stay on the phone for an unbearably long time. And I now, if a dear friend calls and it's the wrong time, I will screen his call and say, you know, it's my good friend Norm. He, you know, we don't ever have phone calls for less than a half an hour, it seems. So I'm not going to take this now. So he becomes a kind of friend on demand, as it were, the way we like news and entertainment. The other thing is inexpensive long-distance calls make it possible to speak fairly frequently with people, you know, far away in other cities, since people, we have such a mobile country with people moving to new jobs and retiring, in ways that in the olden days one wouldn't. I suspect you're not old enough to remember the 3-minute long distance phone call. It was like the 4-minute mile. You know, you would try to speak to relatives in under 3 minutes, you know, to hold the charges down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nowadays that one doesn't think that way because long distance is a great deal less expensive, of course.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned email, which there are all kinds of arguments about whether email's a good thing or a bad thing. Is it inhuman, people say? Some people say it's ruining English prose style, and its scruffiness and quickness with which people compose email. But I must say, I, for one, like it a lot. And as a writer, it's put me in touch with lots of people who would probably never have taken the difficulty to, write out a full letter and put a stamp on it and go down to the corner or whatever is entailed. I also have some friendships that are almost solely based on email. In fact, I have two that I can think of. One are quite intense, but the other, important to me, where I've never met the person, but we've exchanged lots of email, and things have gotten, I won't say, intimate, but, we can joke as if we were people who'd gone to high school together. And one of these is with an English writer and screenwriter who lives in France. And I don't know, I may never see him, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The other's with a man of great literary sensitivity who lives in South Carolina, and who sends me 3 and 4 emails a day. It's true I don't answer them at the length he often sends them to me, but this has been going on for maybe 5 years now, and I know a great deal about his life, and he's come to know a fair amount about mine, and I would bet anything we will never meet, because I sense he's a shy person.
Hmm.
So, there's a new phrase, a not very happy, not very felicitous phrase, called FaceTime.
Mm.
You know this one. It's when I guess there's so much electronic communication going on through telephones and long distance and emails and chat rooms that FaceTime is when you actually see somebody.
Mm-hmm.
see somebody, and obviously that's needed too, but not always. I mean, these two friendships I've just described, I'm not sure how much they would gain by personal contact.
Yeah. Interesting.
Or fleshly contact.
Well, it is also interesting that I have had the experience now of receiving emails from past friends.
Mm-hmm. Do they because they know of you through your radio show?
Or I don't know. They just, they put up. My guess is that you think, I wonder what so-and-so is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then they put your name, you put a name into your browser.
Right.
And, so often you're going to come up with something.
Yes, right.
And it can be, it can be delightful or dreadful.
Yes, no, I know. But the nice thing about email, I think, is that you can also push away, you know, there's always the no reply possibility, you know, at a certain point, unless a, I think it would only become rude unless someone asks you a specific question and you don't reply. But and I've had emails like that too, where people want a little more from me than I want to give, which leads to another thing. This subject is so richly complex. I hope you'll agree. I think you do know this without my having to tell you this, but the normal dynamic of friendship is to deepen it. You know, you and I have this conversation, and we discover that we're simpatico. We have rapport, and I say, you know, I'm coming to Champagne in 2 weeks. Why don't we meet with our husbands and wives for dinner? You know, so suddenly we have that, and then the dinner goes well, and I say, you know, oh, you love Italy too. You're going next fall. We are too. And, you know, and eventually we go with our full extended families to Antarctica. You know, well, who needs that? And you don't need it, and I don't. But there's this tendency for friendships automatically to deepen. Some should and some shouldn't.
Some shouldn't. Yeah.
You know, and some are perfectly fine as what I think of as occasional or modest friendships. There's a man I know who writes me maybe 3 emails a year. He was born and grew up in Chicago. He comes back in August. We have lunch in August once a year. And he doesn't push it any further, and I don't. And I have someone I was in the Army with years ago, the peacetime Army, let me add. And we go to a Cub game in Chicago. And that's fine, you know. And some friends where we don't talk about getting together with wives or husbands and... I think there are calibrations of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall from the book that I speak of with this large number of people I call friends. Of some, you know, some are in my box seat, some are in the grandstand, and some are off in the distant bleachers. But I think of them all as friends.
Why do we choose not to make a deeper connection?
It may be. Well, I think I can think of lots of reasons for not doing it. One is, one feels one's dance card of friendship is kind of filling up, and one's edgy about it, for one thing. Another thing is, one might feel that the other person may want more from you in the way of intimacy than you are willing to give. You know, something puts you off just slightly about it. That's certainly another possibility. And also, there are other things, too. You know, to confide in another person is to render yourself vulnerable in some way.
Mm.
You know, if I tell you all of my, you know, disappointments and sadnesses in life, and then we have a break, you sort of know something that maybe I don't want somebody who's no longer my friend to know.
Mm.
So I think these things have to be thought of very carefully. I think when we're young, we just sort of fall into friendships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the things are sort of set up for us. For example, my last name begins with E. I knew a lot of people whose names began with D and F, you know, if they sat around me in classrooms,
right.
You know, things like that. The neighborhood, friendships are bound in some way. And you fall into them and you find yourself liking this person more than that. But friendship is really a kind of, you know, there are no biological or blood ties to friendship, and it's really in the realm of choice and discernment. The other thing is, I think the golden time for friendship is adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a kind of uninterested high school student, and when I went to high school, I was really going to be with my friends, and I could give full time to friends. But then as one grows older and, you know, the major events in life impinge on one, marriage, you know, job, children, friendship becomes less central, and it can even sometimes be a complicating factor,
yeah,
as you know.
When thinking about friendship, a couple of things leap to mind. A relationship where there is trust, there's genuine caring for another person,
mm-hmm.
and this relationship has to be based on respect.
Mm-hmm.
What else is needed?
Yeah, you know, I think a certain amount of equality. The philosopher Santayana said, "A friend is someone whom you can be most yourself with." You know, which which means that you can also even reveal little flaws and you won't be judged too harshly for them. A certain level of, it's tough to be friends with somebody who is so much superior to one or so much inferior. It makes it tougher. I mean, it can be done, obviously, but it's much more difficult. But I think it's the, and also the notion of reciprocity. Getting back to caring for a moment, caring is a tough, it's a word that shimmers with virtue, but it's very hard to act on. A dear friend of mine died in his late 50s, and he left a wife and son who made a great, great wreck of their lives for reasons of psychological problems, health problems. And I really cared a great deal for my friend.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know what I can do for his wife and son.
Mm-hmm.
If I had vast sums of money, I don't think that would help very much. We don't live in the same city, let me say, too. So I can't even really pay a lot of personal attention to them. I think in modern life, friendship has limitations. Montaigne, the great French essayist, wrote an essay on friendship in which he talked about a friend of his named Étienne de la Boëchée. And he says, he was I was he, we were seamless, what was mine was his, what was his was mine. That's a wonderful ideal, but I don't think anyone has ever really lived up to it. And in fact, Montaigne says there's never been a friendship like it in classical literature, nor will there be again.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Joseph Epstein, his latest book, Friendship in Exposé. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We are joined now by a listener calling in from Eureka, line 4. Hi.
Hi, a very interesting conversation. I wonder if you could just talk maybe ever so briefly about same-gender friendships and cross-gender friendships. Your thoughts about those?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great part of the subject of friendship. The first thing, let me start by saying that I think one of the differences, one of the changes that's come about is that you can have friendships between men and women that aren't, sensual. They're not looking to fall in love with each other, and I make the distinction in this book that there's a real distinction between romantic love and friendship, and there are different emotions that go into the two, and you can't have both simultaneously. Obviously, in marriages, you do still have an element of romantic love and sexual love, but other things become involved, which change that. I think that these kinds of cross-gender, as you say, friendships were very uncommon before the last 50 years or so. They would show up sometimes, in aristocratic cultures or among intellectuals and artists, men and women who were really good friends. Evelyn Waugh and Nancy Mitford, the English writers, Samuel Johnson and Mrs. Thrale, where there was no romantic element, they were just good friends. But I think the great event, surely, of the last 50 or so years has been the freeing of women from the house, if they wish to be freed, going out into the marketplace, the work world. And so women are now colleagues, and they're equals in a way they weren't before. And equality is one of the things that makes friendship possible. And one can have these friendships. I think they're a great, great thing. I think they widen the perspectives of both men and women.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
It seems that there's an ever constant stream of articles about connections and health, and I think one can also imply mental health in terms of friendships, and I think it's true. Could you comment on the mental aspect of friendships, please?
Well, I'm not sure I have a lot of interest to say. I know I've heard it said that people who are relatively friendless are figured to be in mental trouble, and that seems a bit obvious. But just because it's obvious doesn't mean it's not true. And of course, one of the great sadnesses in life is for people who grow old and, you know, all their friends die off and they feel as alone as possible. Mm-hmm. Somehow, my saying this reminds me of an amusing phrase put in the world by an English critic named Hugh Kingsmill. He called friends God's apology. And what God was apologizing for was your family. Mm. He's giving you these friends. Your family you have no choice about, but these friends.
I know in the book, The Transparent Self, I believe the author is now dead, he talks about males not disclosing themselves to other people, and he correlates that to a higher rate of sickness, I think, both physical and mental.
Oh, really? That I should know that, but the truth is I don't. But I think that your original statement is there's no question about it. In fact, it's often said that more men confide in other women than confide in men.
I think that is true.
You know, and there's another thing that's a little even sort of a surprising remark, and that is a lot of men will say my lady friend, my wife, is my best friend, and then they ask the wife or lady friend, and it turns out the husband mate is not her best friend. That's where things get really complicated.
I think it's kind of interesting when you see programs about female police officers. It seems like they really have a positive impact on deflating a lot of conflict situations, maybe by just listening, maybe by being better listener. No, thank you. A very good conversation. I'd like to get your book.
Thank you for those intelligent questions.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Yesterday on this program, July 12th, 2006, we talked with a very interesting fellow by the name of Carl Fleming. He's a journalist, now well into his 70s. His next project, he was a young reporter in the 1960s, and he covered all the major civil rights stories. And he owns up to being, in his younger days, tough and crusty and the stereotypical reporter. And he says, you know, that has so changed, and his friendships have changed. And he's writing a book now about another memoir about his friendships.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, you know, you're mentioning that puts me in touch with another point that I would like to take a moment to try to make. And that is, I think there's been a widening tolerance in the country. Some people may say it's not so real, but, you know, for the first time in the last 20 years or so, one can have heterosexual, homosexual friendships, male and female. And they can be closer than they once were because the element of duplicity under which homosexuals had to live, you know, hiding their homosexuality, has been lifted for so many gay men and lesbian women that people can relax and become friendly. And when you mentioned Carl Fleming and the covering the great civil rights movement, I think it's only now becoming possible for there to be less complicated interracial friendships. One of the great sadnesses of our national history, I think, is that it was so difficult for blacks and whites to have easy friendships as they ought to, without all the psychological tension and political tension that was invested in these things.
Let's get one more call in this afternoon. Line one, listener in Urbana, hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? What a wonderful subject this is.
Yeah, it's so rich. I know.
It really
endless.
Is. I mean, just by you talking about it, I was thinking. I was a military brat, and I met a friend of mine who's truly a friend. When I was 14, and I'm 56 now, we still are just closest friends. I have two brothers and three sisters, but it's amazing how when you talk of your friendships and stuff, and I think of I've just known him so long, and we just know, you know, when we see each other. He's been married three times, and I've met all of his wives. Actually, he was one of his best men at one of his weddings. But he always it's a very, very comforting and nice thing. But in a way, it's really odd because we don't ever speak about failure. Like, he never speaks about it other than the obvious about his failed marriages.
Uh-huh.
And when we dated when we were in high school and then in college, and he was in the Air Force for 20 years. I was in the military. He was in the Army for 2 years in the late 60s and early 70s. And mm-hmm. we never really talk about those things other than, like, he talked about his job. But it's a very interesting relationship. You just made me think about it in a sort of a different context.
You talk about your adolescence a lot with each other.
Because
good old days in high school. And
yeah, well, not as much as you'd think. He basically, his sister, he has a sister who's 6 years older than him. So I was kind of like, when I met him, his sister was gone in college. So,
uh-huh.
But it's like I'm his only family because his parents are both dead now.
Uh-huh.
And but it's very interesting. It's a wonderful, if I were to, I told him once, I said, I just can't imagine not knowing you. And it's really very nice. It's very, very, I don't know, affectionate we like each other.
That's great when that happens. A complicated version of that, I keep harking on this word complication, forgive me, but is when you have an older friend like that, and somehow the world has kicked that friend in the pants in ways that have made him different, or he decides he or she doesn't like the modern world anymore. You know, people get older and they get cranky, or who needs computers, and what do I need this for? And then suddenly you know, there's this dear old friend, and you say, God, he's not there anymore. He's something, the world has made him different. Or I've even had cases of people who sort of fall out of it, but they remain good-hearted, you know, so you sort of don't know what to do. I'll bet, too, that you've met people that you have known for a long time and like, but you say, if you're honest with yourself, you know, if I met this person today, I'm not sure I'd want to befriend him.
Mm-hmm.
It's so endless.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful landscape. It's a geography, really, isn't it?
It is. It really is. It's and a topography with lots of little hills and rivers.
Well, good metaphor. Joseph Epstein, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Sorry to say we're out of time. We've got to go.
Well, great pleasure to have your intelligent questions. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Joseph Epstein, his latest book, Friendship, an Exposé. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day lower in the corn and the bean pits. That led down by the wheat not only in Chicago but in Kansas City and at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange as well. Dave Dickey tells me that there was a lot of profit taking happening as rainfall continues to be in the forecast for portions of those very parched areas of not only the spring wheat areas but of the hard red winter wheat area. Not much to do there because that harvest season, relatively speaking, is over with, but the Minneapolis Grain Exchange down about 23.75 cents today in the deferred September contract. Settlement price there at $4.93.5. Their nearby July at 5.07 on the high, the low at 4.85. Their settlement at 4.85, and they were off 24 cents for the day in the July wheat from the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, or rather from the Kansas City Board of Trade. Minneapolis Grain Exchange was down 30 cents for that July contract at 5.08, and the September contract there at 5.06 1/4 was off 17 3/4. July wheat in Chicago at 3.88 high, low at $3.74. Settlement price at 3.76 was off 14 today. September